This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today I'm going to be talking about popular games. I'm just going to be kind of going through a bunch of the most popular games that exist. I think I've mentioned in a past episode that probably my favorite game right now, one of the only games I really play seriously these days. I play some board games here and there, and of course I play my own games that I'm testing them. And in terms of like video games, the only game that I really play these days is League of Legends. And mostly, I do think it's unfortunately, probably the best, you know, competitive strategy game that exists. Not because its inherent design is the best. Its inherent design is like just, it's fundamentally a lot better than like StarCraft and Street Fighter and stuff, which is not saying all that much. Because there are some larger arc things happening. Like, you know, the fact that the map is large and that it takes time to get to from here to there means that you have to make strategic decisions about where you're going to be. So that, coupled with the minion wave pushing back and forth mechanism, and the fact that execution is really quite capped in League of Legends and other games in the series, those things make it fundamentally, I think, better than a lot of other like strategy games. On another axis, there's only a few games out there that really get the kind of treatment in terms of like post-release patches that a strategy game really needs to thrive and become great. I think strategy games take between 5 and 10 years to really hone into something really great. And that number may even be larger than that, but it's certainly not 2 or 3 years. It's not like you can just produce a strategy game and then just leave it out there. That's a big problem for board games, which inherently, a lot of board games are far, far and away more well-designed in terms of their basic rule sets than something like League. But they don't get the support. It's very hard to support board games. It's very hard to like patch them and update them and stuff. And so they typically just don't get that kind of support. And you also typically can't play them anytime. They're impractical. You can't really do like an online matchmaking system for board games. I mean, you can, but unfortunately that just doesn't really happen in practice. And when it does happen, it's very awkward and clunky. I know there are websites where you can do that kind of thing, but for the most part, it's not what it should be. So you only have, you know, these out of these top AAA games that actually get support and have a good like online community and have all this stuff that that strategy games kind of really need. Out of those, I think League is the best fundamentally, but also I think that Riot has they hired a lot of very young, new, progressive-minded people who are just really trying to take the game in some good directions. And some people have talked about, well, they're on kind of a bit of a patching treadmill. And that's partially true in a large part because the game has just way too much content and they keep expanding the amount of content. So they are going to be on a patch treadmill forever. It's not like they can hone this thing. It's just a damage control situation, unfortunately, for them. But even still, I love reading patch notes. Probably other people who listen to this podcast being interested in game design are also interested in reading patch notes because it's just great to see how other designers are thinking and how they're trying to solve problems. Riot's patch notes are just like legendary. They are the best. I try to make the Oro patch notes in their image, but I don't have the resources. They have like a team, I think, just devoted to, or at least a single person whose entire job it is only to write patch notes and make them all fancy and stuff. So anyway, that's a bit of a digression. I'm going to be talking about popular games. I think I wanted to talk about League a little bit up front because I am not the kind of person who would dislike something because it's popular. In fact, many of my favorite games have been some of the most popular games ever made in their arenas. I generally think that things that are popular tend to be better than things that aren't. Pound for pound, overall, when you really look at the core values that are going on there. So yeah, I'm not at all skeptical about things that are popular. And I should say that going into this because you could get that impression probably from what I'm about to say. So I'm going to talk about some popular games. I actually got an iTunes review comment from someone who said, "I'd like it if he would talk about more concepts in existing popular games and what's good or bad about them." So this is kind of an experiment. I mean, the whole podcast is kind of an experiment. I don't really, you know, every episode I'm sort of trying something a little bit new, and I'm going to keep doing that and just see what works well and what doesn't. I do have a couple of interviews coming down the pipe. So I'm going to start with the Metacritic's top rated games of 2015. So these are the games that, you know, have 7 or more reviews and have the highest overall Metacritic rating. So number one is GTA 5. And that's not too surprising. Grand Theft Auto has been massive since the third game. I remember I worked at, I mentioned before that I used to work at a GameStop that was once a Funko Land. But at that GameStop, I worked there when Vice City came out. And so 3 was this massive explosion, and then Vice City was coming out, and Vice City had this really very pointed aesthetic, 80s aesthetic, and it was like, it was kind of like the coolest thing possible at the time. I was actually not into it even back then. I played the old GTAs, and I thought they were fine, whatever. I played 3 for a little while, and I thought it was pretty cool for a little while, but, you know, I basically played with it like a toy for a little while. I tried doing some missions. I found them to be incredibly boring, and I, you know, pretty much never played it again. And I think one reason is that actually GTA 3 and all the GTAs, they kind of, I think I got a lot of that out of my system back in the day with a game called Carmageddon, which had a lot of the car physics-y stuff, which I would argue is some of the most interesting toy behavior in GTA, is the car physics stuff, like driving off of giant jumps and going on rooftops and all this crazy stuff. And Carmageddon was really fantastic with that. It was just really, it had a lot of like crazy car physics, and it had these power-ups that let you like become bouncy, or a solid granite car was one of the upgrades that would just like let you just plow through, you know, other cars and things like that. And I'm not saying Carmageddon's a good game or toy or anything like that. But I think a lot of the value of GTA 3, and which has most of the value of GTA 4 and San Andreas and 5, you know, I kind of got that out of my system. I was probably a little too old and too experienced with, you know, these kinds of little sandboxy toy things to really... although, to be honest, 5, I don't think I've ever even touched or seen personally. I have played all of the other ones, and I've seen some video of 5, and it seems more or less, you know, in the same general design pocket. And I'm not at all personally interested in it, but I could see young kids being crazy for that kind of stuff. Jumping out of the back of airplanes with a jetpack and exploding things and stuff. I'm highly skeptical of the mission setup because I think GTA is inherently a toy. And I think that it's at its best when you are just kind of messing around and doing silly, crazy stuff and exploring the limits of what the system can do. And I think that, you know, the only thing that can kill a toy, as I've said before, is a goal. And so putting this green arrow, go here, go here, go here thing, and these like chores into that system is just really problematic and really flattens it out. I mean, I've talked before about, I don't think that toys have a lot of value for adults really to begin with, but then you kind of really break that toy with the stupid missions. So I have very little tolerance for those missions. And, you know, the setting is like pretty repulsive. I have no interest. I don't really glamorize crime or shooting people or crashing cars or driving recklessly or anything like that. Now, I mean, I understand how those things are exciting, but I also played a crazy amount of video games as a kid, and I think the excitement of those things does kind of wear off, and then you're kind of just left with the concepts, and the concepts are just, it reminds me a little bit of Cards Against Humanity, where it's, you know, I'm supposed to feel like, ooh, I'm being bad because I'm killing police officers or something. And it just doesn't work at all because the whole thing is kind of set up. It's way too contrived to actually cause that effect to happen. And, you know, the writing in those games is like, it's just like, you know, a bad TV show. It's terrible. It's even at its best, it's like, you know, a good moment of that Law and Order show, which I occasionally see, and is the worst. What's that one? Special Victims Unit. Yeah, it's like a completely god-awful show. And GTA's dialogue and storytelling is kind of like that. And so, yeah, it's pretty much entirely, I would say GTA is like all bad, except there's a good toy in there, sort of. Not a great toy, but there's like a pretty good little physics toy to play with cars. When you're running around on foot, it's awful. It's just pure noise. So I really dislike the whole on foot aspect, but being in a car and doing some physics-y stuff is, you know, I can understand how that, or jumping out of planes or, you know, anything like that. Those are all kind of good physics-y things. However, I do think that Gary's Mod probably does what it does better. So that's my opinion on GTA 5, not specifically on GTA 5 because I haven't played that one, but I'm pretty sure that my criticism of the GTA series, especially 3 onward, would probably apply to 5. The second one is Metal Gear Solid 5. A lot of fives. This is the second top rated game of 2015. And, you know, that's the Metal Gear Solid series. And, I can't believe, I mean, apparently this happened like 6 months ago. The original like game of Metal Gear 5 came out, and I guess more recently there was some kind of like expansion or some other DLC or something that came out. And so I hadn't even noticed when it came out. I just didn't hear about it. But there's this character named Quiet, and it's a female character who's in a bikini, of course, and her name is Quiet, and she can't speak. And she's, like, doing stripper dances in like, various cutscenes. And it's just, you know, it's basically the worst on that axis. And the worst part is that Kojima, he seems to be, like, just this kind of gross gamer dude guy who he like jokes about that kind of stuff. He's just like really, really not on the ball with regards to how to portray women and how to like think about women and how to like think of them as human beings. And you know, he has this totally asinine explanation for why she has to be naked all the time, which is that she breathes through her skin. Which is just totally absurd. They could have at least gone all the way and made her completely naked. In which case, you know, like then I can maybe accept that a little more. I mean, I totally wouldn't accept it, of course, but that's just totally the worst. And as to the gameplay, I watched some video. I mean, I've played a few of the Metal Gear Solid series and the old Metal Gears, of course, as well. And I did watch some Metal Gear Solid 5. I remember I put on a person playing and commentating Metal Gear Solid 5, and they were playing this one mission that's out in the desert or something, and the guy's avatar was like crawling because they were like crawling up to the next checkpoint so that they didn't get detected. But he was sitting there crawling like in a straight line for, I don't know, it must have been at least like 5-10 minutes. Which is really a long time when you're just sitting there watching that for like 5 minutes. So there's a lot of downtime, it seems like, in Metal Gear Solid 5. And when it's not downtime, you know, you're shooting at bots or you're just walking through this little puzzle corridor, you know, you have to like walk through when the guards aren't looking, and you have to like press the quick time event when to kill the guard. And, you know, it's just totally like year 2000, nothingness. You know, Metal Gear Solid doesn't even have the toyness. I think that Metal Gear almost entirely relies on name and spectacle, although I'm actually surprised at how long it has been able to stretch out that spectacle effect. Because, you know, the original Metal Gear Solid, when it came out, was a huge spectacle because it looked way more like a movie than any video game before it had. You know, it had, I remember these, like, the sort of film-like credits rolling over the intro and, like, all this cinematography, camera angles, all this kind of stuff. And so that was very spectacular. And, you know, I remember my, whatever, 18-year-old self being extremely impressed by that. Or maybe I was 17, 16. I don't remember exactly what year that came out. But I was extremely impressed by that at the time. Although I do remember even back then, I had a friend who was playing and I always wanted him to play. I tried playing a few times and I just always felt like it was really clunky. And, you know, you're just doing these like lame puzzles that are mostly just annoying to do. Like, it wasn't the least bit fun. And I feel like that's kind of how they've always been. I do think that I know with 3, it got a little, Metal Gear Solid 3, it got a little more sandboxy in some moments. And I've heard some stories about kind of things that you can do in those. And that's a step in the right direction, I suppose. But, you know, I guess what I would advocate them to do for Metal Gear Solid would be to drop the cinema stuff completely, get rid of those cutscenes. I mean, some of the cutscenes are so long. I think number 4 had a 40-minute opening cutscene, something like that, 50-minute maybe even. And they're just the worst. They're way worse than GTA because they're like this weird Japanese translated bizarre thing with Solid Snake in it, who is like this total not character anime horrible thing. And of course, yeah, the stories are just notoriously like fever dream and everything. That's one thing. That's what everyone focuses on. But, you know, even if they're fever dream, they could have good scripts. So I would still recommend that Metal Gear should become, I don't know, maybe it should become like an MMO or some kind of just open fantasy world simulator thing. It's hard to really say what the future is for that. I mean, I kind of don't think it really... I don't really think it needs to exist. I think, you know, the first few games made sense, the first few solids, because they were cashing in on the spectacle of, hey, this is a video game that really looks like a movie, and it even has long, long cutscenes. But people have to be kind of getting over that a little bit. And I suppose that these Metacritic ratings fly in the face of that claim. But I think that both ratings and sales are largely... It takes a long time for them to move, especially at this level of like AAA. I think that people sort of just buy the games that they buy, and it's like the next, you know, the next Metal Gear, the next whatever, next GTA. Like, people are just gonna buy it. You know, it doesn't really matter what it is or if the last one was boring. It's kind of like ingrained in people's culture to just buy the things, and so, you know, and kind of just play them and then say they liked them. And I don't think that people are thinking very critically about them. Now, I will say, going back to what I said earlier, that I do think that they are probably the best. They do the best job at the things that they are trying to do. So, like, in terms of being a big, like, cinematic spectacle, I think probably Metal Gear is among the best things out there, because, you know, just so many resources have gone into it. They've been doing it a long time, and there's just not a lot of really very fierce competition in that regard. Now, I'm talking about, you know, a cinematic, super cutting-edge technology spectacle. So I'm not just saying any games that are cinematic. There are some games that are very cinematic and are even kind of well-written, but they don't have the same kind of, like, AAA, you can tell millions and millions of dollars were spent on this kind of feel to them. And I think that's a big part of the appeal. I think people, when they buy a Metal Gear, the new Metal Gear Solid game or the new GTA, they kind of are doing that because it makes them feel like they're part of this big moment. It's like, oh, the, you know, Metal Gear Solid 5 came out and did you buy it? And that's really, they're more just like kind of participating in this cultural exercise rather than it having anything to do with what you actually do or what's going on in the game, anything like that. So yeah, that's Metal Gear Solid 5. The next one down is Witcher 3. And I did play the first Witcher. I can't really speak to Witcher 3 that much because, you know, I haven't played it, and I'm less familiar with it than and that series in general than the other games. So I won't speak about that much, but I will say that RPGs, I've talked a little bit before about RPGs and grinding and how that's completely unacceptable. And I do remember that the writing in the first game was just total trash. I remember that they were like really awkwardly using like lots of swear words. I think that was, there was like a, when the first Witcher came out, that was a very glamorous thing to do, was put a lot of swear words in your game. So they would just cram them in everywhere they could. And that was really bad. It was like really very uncomfortable to experience. I don't know if they've gotten better on that axis or on the other axes, but I do know that it's an RPG and it's an action RPG. So you know, I know that you're fighting a bunch of hordes of monsters and mashing buttons and grinding. And so that is probably not a great thing. If you can handle RPGs, though, if you are interested in playing RPGs, I have heard many people say that The Witcher 3 is a good one on the axes that one would judge an RPG to be good. So I can't really say too much about Witcher 3, but I will say that it's an RPG, and the reason I don't know what it is and I haven't played it and I won't play it is that it is an RPG. And so yeah, that's enough of a reason for me to not play things anymore. And speaking of which, even if Witcher was like good in some ways, I still wouldn't play it, and the proof for that is that I didn't play Undertale, which is number 4. Actually, it's the 4th top rated game on Metacritic. And that is very, very cool because Undertale, I mean, first of all, from a interactive systems perspective, Undertale is terrible. It's really bad. You have to walk around, you have to, you know, walk down long corridors, you have to grind, you have to engage in horrible, boring combat all the time. And, you know, it's basic on an interactive systems level, it's basically indistinguishable from like Final Fantasy. So it's terrible. And that, because of that, I was not unable to play it. However, it also has a strong anti-violence message. I did some research on the game and I kind of just read what like a synopsis and watched a couple of videos of people explaining, as well as showing some stuff from the game. So I've had the game thoroughly spoiled for me, which I wanted, because there was no way I was going to go. I wanted to like experience it, but there was no way I was going to go through JRPG hell again. I've played way too many JRPGs in my day to ever sit through that again. But the game has a strong anti-violence message, as I mentioned, and that's just really fantastic and really rare and totally the opposite of every other video game. And I'm really glad that it has been so well received. And I hope that that starts a conversation about violence, one that I've been trying to start for a while and really hasn't gotten its own wings. Gotten its own legs. So as much as I would have liked so far anyway. So I'm very happy to see Undertale there, although I would never play it. To me, it's agony at this point because, you know, the thing is, a lot of these games, like most video games, just straight up, you know, pretty much all of these ones I'm talking about now, you know, I spent my whole life playing them and not enjoying them, really. And then at a certain point, it was like, once I noticed that I wasn't enjoying them, it was kind of like all of that, like, I actually turned into like a very angry kind of, not angry, but just, like resenting that they were so crappy and that they kind of made this promise to me that they were something that they weren't. And you know, I talk about, RTS games as a good example of that, the promise of RTS games. I my whole life I've been playing them, and I always thought of them as like this super modern chess, you know, like some just the most advanced war game that exists, you know, and it's a strategy game, and it's all about coming up with strategies. And, you know, ultimately though, it's kind of not, it's, you know, you go and you know what the top three or whatever strategies are, and then you execute them as best as you possibly can. And that's what it really kind of is all about. Strategy is a very small part. It's not nothing in StarCraft and games like that, but execution's like a good 80-90%. And just knowing efficient build orders and all these kinds of things. So, you know, I realized that, I felt like kind of betrayed. And it was even worse with things like RPGs and stuff, because I guess to some extent I kind of bought into the whole idea of RPGs, that RPGs, you know, they're more than just, I mean, yeah, you're just walking down the hallways and, you know, you get these random encounters and then you like, yeah, you just mash A and stuff to fight, but it all adds up to this great, big, awesome thing. And the stories are pretty good, right? And, you know, they're cool with the cutscenes and everything. And, you know, it's like I in my mind, I spent so long defending these things to myself on some level. And so then once you realize like, oh, wait, no, they're actually just like kind of just awful thoroughly. It's like you hate them even more. And the idea of playing them now is just like so abhorrent to me because of that. All right, so that's a few of Metacritic's top rated games. I'm going to move on to something a little more productive, a little more positive, which is Board Game Geek's top rated board games. Now, from about 2011 to 2014, I was super into board games. It was crazy. I bought probably 20 or 30 board games, and I probably bought about 10 to 15 board games, maybe 20. But then I went, Board Game Geek has a trading system, and I did like 150 trades in like a couple of years, which was great. It allowed me to try out tons and tons of games. So I was able to play a lot of games, but in the last year or so, I think what happened was my learning about board games, as I got to a certain threshold, it sort of started curving off. I started seeing the same patterns over and over again, and I started just feeling like, okay, I kind of get it about like what people are doing in the board game world at this point. And I still have a lot to learn for sure, but I have less to learn than I did when I started in 2011. So because I've been out of the loop for the last year or so, I haven't played, you know, all of the top 10 or so games. So I'm just going to go through in the top 20 games, those games that I have played enough to comment on. And I know that there's a big threshold crossing over into the board game world. A lot of people and maybe some listeners are only video game players. But I really recommend, if you haven't played some of those top games on Board Game Geek, just like make it a thing. Especially if you're a game designer, make an effort to go and buy some of these games and learn them. And, you know, it's highly annoying. It's highly annoying to learn them. It's highly annoying to set up times to play them. But I really recommend it. It's very much worth it. And at the very least, find a lot of the publishers provide the manuals to games, and find those manuals and read them at least, and try to really understand them, because I just think that'll really open up people's minds a lot in terms of what's possible with game design. So the first game on the list that I have actually played is The Fifth Game Down, which was the number one game for many years, and that's Puerto Rico, and I've mentioned that game a few times on the show, and some people may already know it. It's one of the most popular board games and one of the most liked. It is a game where it's like a role selection game, and so like I'll pick a role, and then I get to do this power, and everyone else at the table also does that power. I just do it a little bit better, kind of, and then the person to my left picks a role that can't be the role I just picked, and he picks it, and we all do that role, but he does it a little better, and we kind of go around in a circle, and we're building these little machines, and we're selling off goods, and we're doing, you know, we're cutting each other off and stuff. It's pretty competitive, although it's definitely like a Euro game in that, like, you have your own little machine that you're building, and there's very little areas where the machines connect to each other in terms of my machine and my opponent's machines. I like Puerto Rico. I've played many, many matches of it. There's actually a digital version of Puerto Rico, which I highly, highly recommend, called Tropic Euro. And it's free. It's like a Java applet type of thing. And I play that thing all the time. It's got bots, and it's a lot of fun. And so my feelings about Puerto Rico are basically that it's good, but the limitations of it are that it's kind of, well, there's not a really great information horizon. You can kind of just calculate things a lot, and that's what players do, good players do, and I'm very limited in my ability to get very good at the game, because I kind of refuse to do that, all that calculation. Like, I think there should be like a, you know, a, I don't know, 30-second timer or 25-second timer on turns, to just for now. I mean, that's not a great answer, but just allowing people to sit there for 5 minutes and just calculate out the best move is kind of bad in the way that it's bad in like a chess or something. So it's a little too open information, and it needs a little more hidden information, I would say. Also, the interaction between players is it's kind of disconnected, but it's also kind of abrupt. So you can really like screw a player over, and when you choose to do that, it's like right in their face. It's you know, it's a lot of people think of these Euro games as very indirect, but in Puerto Rico it's pretty direct. I mean, you know, it's not themed as punching you in the face, but if they, you know, they can basically punch you in the face. So it's weirdly too direct, but also weirdly indirect at the same time, in that like those kinds of punch you in the face moments don't happen very often. So a lot of the game, you're just sitting there plinking around with your little single player machine, and then all of a sudden another player just punches you in the face and like destroys half your castle. And so it's kind of like bad on both ends in that regard. I wish it was harder to look ahead. Player inputs didn't affect each other so immediately, but the player inputs affected each other more frequently. They do affect, you know, by doing the role selection system in Puerto Rico, there is a constant little player select, there's a constant interaction in that sense, but that's like a really small interaction, and even that actually is very direct. So anyway, my complaints about Puerto Rico are very small. Generally, I think it's one of the best games probably ever created, and so I'm not complaining about it a lot. But I do think it would be hard to improve on it without changing it dramatically. So the next game down that I've played a lot of was Agricola. That's the number 6 highest rated game on Board Game Geek. And I've played it a lot in person and also on the iOS app, which I recommend playing with, especially in single player mode. Now, Agricola, I think, is inherently a single player game. And I wouldn't say that for all Euro games, but necessarily. Most of them are kind of inherently single player, but Agricola really is. And you can just play it at single player out of the box. It even comes with a single player mode. So I recommend it single player, because otherwise you just have these random events happening where other players suddenly take actions and then, oh, a resource disappeared randomly. And a lot of people think that you can just, it's not random when players like steal the resource that you were going to take, but it is random. And the idea that it's not random is based on this belief that you can kind of like read opponents or something. And first of all, Agricola is such a complicated game to begin with. There's no way you're going to be like sitting there also reading two or three other players' like motivations and, you know, doing that kind of stuff. And also, I don't believe that you can do reading anyway to any meaningful degree. And also, reading is this like external skill that has nothing to do with the game. And this is something I've talked about before. Perhaps I need to do an episode about that entirely, about reading opponents and how I don't think it's really a thing. But Agricola is, there's some really cool things about Agricola. I love some of the resource systems in it. And it's kind of fun to play with in a way, in almost a toyish kind of way, because you are basically trying out all these combinations of things and seeing what happens. I think Le Havre, by the same designer, Uwe Rosenberg. I'm not good at pronouncing things, sorry. That is a much better game than Agricola. It's much more just well-designed, I think. And both of those have iOS apps, and I do recommend people check them out. Agricola has some really huge design flaws, though, also. Like, in the beginning of the game, you actually draw 14 cards to your hand. And now these are not just like number cards or something. Each of these cards has a sentence to a paragraph of text on it for what its special power is. And you're drawing 14 of these at the start of the game. And you have to, and like literally you have to sit there for like a good, at least 5-10 minutes or so. And everyone's got to sit there and look at all their cards and just like try to wrap their head around, okay, well, how am I going to make a strategy out of these 14 cards that are all detailed? And it's very messy. It's one of the sloppiest design decisions I've seen in a popular game, board game, for sure. But it's not, you know, it's not a bad, it's not terrible. And I do recommend playing that one. But I recommend Le Havre even more. Okay, the next one down that I've played actually is Android Netrunner. And I think the way I would explain what Android Netrunner is it's Magic the Gathering for people who are too ashamed to admit that they're playing Magic the Gathering. Because it basically, so it does away with a few of the like really big, horrible red flags about Magic. One of which being the CCG model, which a lot of people, especially adults, are kind of just like ashamed to be taking part in, rightfully so. And it's also just very impractical. I mean, it's just annoying to have to deal with like booster packs and all this nonsense. This instead has an LCG model, which means limited card game. And that means that they, at the very least, you know what you're buying. They release these expansion packs every X months or whatever. And each of them have a bunch of new cards, but you know what cards are in there that you're buying. So it's still a CCG. It's just not, it doesn't have booster packs, basically. And it also has a lot more structure actually to it than Magic. Magic is really just you throw a bunch of resources on the table, you know, or hit point bags, and I'll throw a bunch down, and then we'll just shoot damage cards at each other until someone dies. It's very like Street Fighter, the card game. You know, it's very, there's not much of a system there. It's just my cards are going to shoot your cards and let's see who wins. And Android Netrunner has a lot more going on. It has, you are kind of it's inherently asymmetrical, which I kind of like. There's one player is the hacker and the other player is this corporation, and the hacker is trying to steal these cards, these like victory point cards basically. And so the corporation is like on the one on defense. They can like set up these little servers, they call them, and you can place like protective walls in front of the servers. But sometimes they will put like a decoy thing or even a trap behind some of those protective walls. So, you know, there's a lot more like rules to learn in this game, in that it actually has a structure and stuff. But the thing is, it's basically comes down to a big old bluffing game. So instead of like in Magic, I can just see what your units all are and I'm going to shoot them and kill you. Now it's kind of like I have, on top of that, it is kind of like that. It is all still pretty direct. But on top of that, now I have to like guess which of the cards you put on the table is the real card. And I'm not even kidding. Like that is what it comes down to. So it's just as random as Magic. Like you're drawing cards and there's like cards that let you draw three more cards and just all this like crazy, silly crap. But at the same, then not only that, but like you can like fake each other out and, you know, like bluffing and all this stuff. So that's like basically, to me, that's like, you know, chess, where you play chess and at the end of the match you roll a die, and if you roll one, I lose, and if you roll two through six, I win. Something like that. You know, it's just totally super random thing on top of everything else. So I am not a fan of Android Netrunner at all, and I think it's extremely random and still pretty much a CCG in disguise, and not much better than Magic. And so yeah, that's Android Netrunner. That's not a recommendation. The next one down is Eclipse. I'm not going to talk about this one too much. I played the digital version a bunch, trying desperately to like it. It has dice roll combat. That's pretty much all I have to say to point out. Because the problem is, the game is somewhat random throughout the rest of it. But then, like, a lot of times, you know, you have these big space battles, and they're just decided by dice. I mean, they really are. So it's this huge, it's kind of like Risk, you know, you might as well just play Risk, honestly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this game, Eclipse, but it's kind of a pain to learn it all. And yeah, you may as well just play Risk. And, I've noticed Eclipse shot up. It was a new game a couple of years ago, and it shot up to really high on the list. I think it was up to like number five or something, and now it's gone back down a bunch. So hopefully people are also getting fed up with the random dice roll combat, which I think is just totally lazy and terrible. Those are some board games. There's also Power Grid is number 13. There's a few others on there that I've played. I'll just quickly mention a couple other board games while I'm on the topic that I do like. One is Pandemic, which is a cooperative game. Through the Desert is a two-player, well, it's can be 3, 4, 5 player even, but primarily it's like a two-player abstract game, kind of like a more advanced design of Go, I would say. So I would say just look into those two. So for the last segment, I'm going to also bring up I just looked on Wikipedia. I was like, what are the best selling video games? And I know I've looked this up before, but, it might be interesting to just talk about what the world's best selling video games of all time are. These aren't highest rated of 2015, which is what I was talking about before, but these are best selling of all time. So the number one is Tetris, which kind of makes sense. It's like really is super elegant. A lot of people talk about that, but I think they just means it's simple, but it really is. It does get a lot of bang for its buck. Now it's, you know, its buck, so to speak, is, you know, is extremely simple. It's like a very simple abstract game. You can't do much with it. And given how simple it is, you do get a lot of complexity for that simplicity. But overall, the complexity really isn't enough, actually. Like, I think that a lot of players have, like, mostly mastered Tetris. Like, they mostly get it. And now they're just, if they still play, they're just, like, playing, waiting for good rolls. And what I mean by that is, like, they're just waiting for the line to come at the right moment and, like, various things to happen at the right moments. Or even for, if they're playing at a very high level, the speed, the execution, they're just waiting for their execution to, like, happen properly. And so I think it's a combination of that. They're basically, Tetris becomes just sitting there and clicking and waiting, you know, a Skinner box. Weirdly enough, it does at once you get to a certain degree of play. Now, early on, there is a decent amount of stuff to actually learn about the game, like little strategies and tactics about how to, you know, how you can use a piece this way and et cetera. But I think that players kind of get through that somewhat quickly, and then it just becomes waiting and clicking and hoping. So, you know, I still like Tetris. I think it's good. It's good that we have it. And I think it's great if you're like a young person and it's a great little, like, fun little app, you know, that's a good thing to have around. But I think people overstate how genius it is. And I also think that people overstate its replay value. It has a lot of replay value because it just becomes super random at the end. And then people are just clicking and waiting for things to happen that are good. So it doesn't really have a lot of replay value, actually. And while it is pretty elegant, it's not complex enough to really be interesting for actually very long. So, you know, and that's something I talk about with abstract games. Some people have argued, have like sort of tried to tell me that, oh, my podcast is just for people who want to make abstract games. No, I am actually against abstract games. I think abstract games are too simple. I think that we need that, the extra complexity given to us by thematic material in order to make games that are complex enough so that if they're, you know, instead of 1 point complexity into becoming 3 points of complexity through their emergent complexity, we can have like maybe 5 points of complexity becoming 25. And then that's like a good amount of, you know, emergent complexity and depth, real depth for an adult person to play with for a long time. So that's Tetris. And by the way, Tetris sold 100 million copies, apparently, according to Wikipedia. The second one down is Wii Sports. And I know a lot of that number is kind of inflated because it came with the Wii. Although, you know, I can't take that away from it, I suppose. It's funny. Actually, I think that Wii Sports is kind of like Tetris in that it doesn't do a lot, but what it does do, it does pretty well. And it's just kind of like a well put together little parlor game thing. It's like very easy to learn. It has, you know, it's not totally trivial to master. Some of the games more than others. Because if people don't know, Wii Sports is this title that came with the Wii, and you use the Wiimote to play all these sports games. So there's like a tennis game, there's a golf game, there's a boxing game. I'm trying to remember what else there was. There was a bunch of little sport games, and, you know, I think that Wii Sports is a smart thing for someone to have made. And I think Nintendo did a good job. Of course, they are sports, and not only are they sports, but they're like super boiled down versions of sports. So they're pretty shallow. But, you know, overall, I can't really complain about Wii Sports. It's not something I would want to ever play, really. But it's definitely good that it exists. And that's not something I would say for a lot of these five sequels of AAA games, which really just don't need to exist. Wii Sports adds something to the world, you know, that now you can like play this little bowling thing with your family. And, you know, and it's, I understand why it's popular and why it really helped the Wii a lot succeed as a console. The next one down is Minecraft, which sold 71 million. Wii Sports was 82. and Tetris was 100. So next one down is Minecraft. And I've talked before about Minecraft and how, you know, I did an old podcast actually, and I had one episode where we were talking about Minecraft and how Minecraft has probably just done such a huge favor to this generation of kids that are growing up now playing Minecraft instead of, you know, they might have been doing like RuneScape or Pokemon or some other horrible grindy thing. Now, Minecraft does have grinding and it does have some bad aspects, but at its core, it's just this big digital Legos toy. And it's about crafting, it's about creating things, and it's about, you know, solving problems. And I think that it's generally a very good thing that that Minecraft, you know, came and became so popular. I also, as a side note, I like that it really, I think it sent a message that, you know, these AAA graphics doesn't matter. It's just like, it's totally irrelevant to anything. And I hope that Minecraft will create a very strong or powerful, like, hole in the whole philosophy of, you know, gotta buy the latest hardware and the latest whatever. And, you know, because Minecraft, you could have probably made Minecraft or something a lot like it on, I don't know, the PlayStation 1 or maybe even the PlayStation 2. And, but, you know, no one thought of it. No one did it. I say that often. I think a better example is that someone could have made Smash Brothers on the Atari 2600. And certainly, if not on the 2600, they could have on the NES. And yeah, it wouldn't have looked exactly the same, but it would have played exactly the same, and it would have been a giant hit, especially if they had all the Nintendo character IPs. But I'm just saying, someone could have made that. And I know, as a kid, if someone had made Smash Brothers, I would have loved it as on the NES, but just no one thought of it. And so I hope that Minecraft makes this generation think about, you know, it's about the ideas, it's about the design, it's about the interactivity, it's not about are you using the latest software, hardware rather. So I think that's really good. Now, as for me playing Minecraft or another adult playing Minecraft, with few exceptions, I don't see why an adult would want to do that. If you want to like use it as a creation tool, you're really just better off using like Maya or 3ds Max or Unity and just making your whatever you want to make. Use better tools for that. But other than that, like, I just can't picture why an adult would want to sit there and like collect resources, virtual resources, or, you know, any of the other activities that you can do in Minecraft. I definitely understand why a young, like a person, a child would want to do that. And I would have been crazy about that when I was probably maybe even as old as like 20 years old. Like I said, toys are not complicated enough for the adult mind. There's not enough there. And Minecraft is like the toy. So, you know, Minecraft totally is great that it exists. It's not really great for adults, but it's wonderful that it exists. And it definitely is a valid invention. And I'm glad it was made. The next one's GTA 5. I already spoke about that one. That one's sold 54 million, and that's the first one of this list to be a new game. And yeah, that one sold 54 million. Now, I think part of that is that the industry has just been getting bigger and bigger since, you know, when Tetris came out or whatever. Now, I guess directly undermining that argument is that right after GTA 5 is the next game is Super Mario Brothers, the original one for NES, which sold 40 million. Super Mario Brothers, like you know, I mean, tons has been said about that game. It probably started video games, basically. It like really kicked off the whole thing. And a few things that I guess I could say about it that others have not are that, first of all, it's my favorite Mario game by far. And the reason is that there was the least things getting in the way of the core of the system in the first game. So even by the second game, you had, you know, Peach. Well, if we're talking about the American second game, actually the Japanese second game I might like even more than the original. But let's talk about 3 and World and certainly all the other 3D ones. The first game, you know, this basic concept of you jump and you have this inertia and you're going and there's all this tension as you're in the air and you're like trying to evade things. And, you know, it's shallow because it's just about jumping and jumping through hoops. But there's at least this little tension engine that makes sense in there where you jump and you're like, oh, I hope I land on this thing. I hope, you know, and this tension release arc curves, right? Mario, the first Mario and the second Japanese Mario had that, and it was totally unadulterated and it was totally unscrewed with. By three, they added things like the raccoon tail, which allowed you to like slowly descend from your jumps, totally killing them. And they also gave you a lot more midair control. That got a lot worse in Super Mario World, where you can like just undo your jump midair. And you had the feather and the cape and all that stuff. So all the flying stuff is really bad for Mario games. Probably the worst, the climax to this story might be Super Mario Sunshine, which just lets you hover in midair at any time. I don't know if that's the worst. There are other really bad ones that just destroy the tension of the jump. The Mario Sunshine one is a pretty egregious example, but also Galaxy has a little double jump thing where you spin, that also like really kind of kills the jump. I think that the first game is the best because for one thing, it's just very elegant. It's just very simple. It's very to the point. It does, you know, a pretty good amount with a very small amount. And, you know, you get the value of a Mario game by playing that, and it's not, stepping on its own toes. Whereas I think all the Mario games that have flying, I mean, flying is such a stupid concept in number three and World. You know, the whole idea is like, oh, I can just fly over a whole level. Like, how is that good? How is that a good thing? It was a spectacular thing. And I was certainly excited by it when I was 8 years old. And maybe that was the goal. Like, let's just do something that 8-year-olds will find exciting, even if it like damages the game. Because that's totally what it does. It's not even a platformer if you're just letting me fly over half the level, which you absolutely can do in Super Mario World. And you sometimes can do in 3, and also 3 has a thing called the P-Wing, I think it was called, that's just an item that just lets you skip levels, but it actually makes you fly over the whole thing. Very strange. Super Mario Brothers, also obviously fantastic music, and actually I would say fantastic art in the original Mario Brothers. I love how much solid color there is. I love... it's just good graphic design, the original Mario Brothers. So, and I really appreciate that a lot. And it's super clear. It's the clearest Mario game, probably. And although, you know, 3 and even World aren't far behind, it is the clearest visually. And I do appreciate that. It's the simplest to learn. You know, I'm glad that it's the best-selling Mario game because I think it's also the best. And, yeah, so that's a bunch of video games and board game stuff too. So yeah, just a bunch of random thoughts. Hopefully I'll get some, I don't know, let me know what you thought of this. I doubt I would do something ever like this ever again, but you know, if there might be some kind of category, a genre that I can talk about, certain games. And, you know, let me know if you have had similar experiences with any of these games or what you think. Of course, I'm sure people will. So yeah, that about wraps it up then. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Thanks for listening.